Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to the New Books in Indian Religions podcast, a podcast channel here on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran. More importantly, today I have the pleasure of speaking once again on the podcast with Dr. Andrea Acri on a very exciting publication. Andrea is actually assistant professor in Tantric Studies at the École Pratique des Hautes Études in Paris, France. And he is the co-editor, along with Paolo Rosari, on a volume called Tantra, Magic, and Vernacular Religions in Monsoon Asia. Andrea, welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
So tell us how one conceives of a volume entitled Tantra, Magic, and Vernacular Religions in Monsoon Asia. How did this come about?
Well, I think both Paolo and myself wanted to fill a gap. Current scholarship on Tantra. There is quite a lot of interest in Tantra. Many scholars are studying various traditions, various aspects of this phenomenon, but still, this Tantra remains a bit elusive. And so there are still gaps in our understanding of this phenomenon. And we really wanted to actually fill this gap, especially where we individuated a few problems. One problem is the geography. So we chose a broad geographical approach. So we chose Monsoon Asia rather than focusing on Tantra in a single, region or macro region like South Asia, India, or Southeast Asia, East Asia, but really to have this broad perspective that I think really helps us to understand the big picture, to make sense of certain dynamics that were not so clear before. And we have a very broad chronological approach. So we have chapters dealing with the pre-modern medieval period, let's say from the 6th, 7th century up to the present. And so also methodologically, we really wanted to be broad, to have not only scholars working on texts like myself, but also ethnographers, and art historians, so as to try to capture the elusiveness of Tantra from many different methodological point of view. This is pretty much, yeah.
Yeah, certainly traditions as broad and vast as, say, Tantra, they don't always cooperate with national boundaries. And so it's perhaps wise to look at a broader region that you describe as Monsoon Asia for more of a generalist audience. Describe Monsoon Asia. What would that apply to?
Yes. So Monsoon Asia, broadly speaking, is a region, a macro area, a region of Asia where you have similar geo-environmental factors. For example, the monsoon winds, so the seasonal winds that every year, more or less at the same, around the same time, change direction. And those winds influence the climate, for example, they bring rain. And also they influence in the past you know, the connections, the connectivity between areas of Asia that were far from each other, for example, India and China, you know, so the via Southeast Asia. So people traveled by sea very much, and the monsoon really allowed this connectivity to happen. And the monsoon influenced also aspects of culture and religion. We have similar, you know, for example, cultigens, we have similar plants, fruits, crops, you know, and also probably they influence the cosmology, you know, the religious systems elaborated that by many people with very different cultures. So we don't want to kind of, you know, say that people in Monsoon Asia are all the same. You're saying that this area, it makes sense to study this area as a connected system. So an area going from the Indian Ocean, especially the, let's say, the coasts of India to China, all the way to China and Japan. But even the interior, so for example, the interior of China was connected to the coast. The interior, you know, the interland of India, even the Himalayan region was very much connected and part of this system. So just like Eurasia, so scholars talk about, for example, Europe connected all the way to Russia and even Japan, you know, I think we can also speak about Monsoon Asia. And this concept, in fact, was already applied to Oriental studies, let's say, by early scholars, in particular French scholars. One really very, very important is Paul Mus, who wrote about, you know, Hinduism in Vietnam from a Monsoon Asian perspective. So saying we cannot always take for granted that India was the cradle of Indic religions, and then which then they were exported, but there are more complex dynamics at play. So it kind of applied, you know, took Monsoon Asia as a theater to study the movement of religions, of cults and people.
Would you say a word about the use of the term magic in this context?
Yes, so magic is a contested word, a contested term, is difficult to define. And so I know that quite a lot of scholarship exists, but it's also true that scholarship has tended to focus on, you know, let's say Western magic, classical, you know, like Greek, Latin, ancient Roman magic, Egypt. Not so much work has been done on magic in Asian context. And this is definitely true, but I think we do not, let's say we accept the term magic as a kind of, you know, convenient, useful category. As long as you define it, it's fine. And I think you can really individuate this something that was magic, so this ritual procedure, maybe we can call it. We can focus, for example, on the ritual, you know, actions or practice, or magic as ritual practice. Or, for example, on the substances, the magical substances that were used. Or we can also try to, you know, transcend this category. In fact, one chapter in the book contains a critique of this term that, according to the author, cannot be applied, for example, to Sri Vidyata, to South Indian tantric tradition. You cannot use the term magic, but you have to go imic and so imagine other categories. But I think this we wanted to have this in the title, really, to draw attention to this aspect, still relatively neglected, of the vast and multifarious phenomenon of tantra.
Let's perhaps, since we've just mentioned it in passing, let's perhaps talk a little bit about the Sri Vijaya article by Monica Hirmer regarding that critique. Say a bit more about her thoughts on the use of magic for this particular Sri Vijaya tradition.
Yes, well, actually she starts, I mean, her critique is very much grounded in Western philosophy. On the one hand, I think she discussed Heidegger and other philosophers, Wittgenstein, for example. But also she has a kind of, you know, she also starts, she approaches the phenomenon from an embodied perspective. So she spent a lot of time in Tamil Nadu, in South India. And so she really kind of, she was able to capture the emic element. And so at some point, she said that she could not, no longer, she was no longer distinguished by the people in the community that regarded her as an Indian person. Now she took a new name, a new identity, so to speak. So it's kind of, she developed this concept of beingness. And she kind of concerts a modern scientific framework, which is indeed kind of materialistic, and the emic framework, which is very different. So, for example, I mean, the cosmological aspect of the macrocosmos and the microcosmos are very much involved in correspondences, and magic is very much about that, and Tantra is very much about that, working with correspondences between the macrocosmos and the microcosmos, because the everyday reality and internal realities. So you kind of have to access this new ontology in order to make sense and not just define practices as magic, which is a very laden category. It's really loaded with even prejudice, we can say, so Western prejudice. And it's not useful. So we don't need magic. We can explain what is going on by accessing other categories, other terms, which were elaborated by the tradition.
Yeah, it calls to mind other terms that are certainly technical terms within religious studies that have sometimes pejorative undertones in common parlance, terms such as myth or cult. You know, so it clearly sometimes we use terms in a technical sense that may carry wittingly or unwittingly other baggage historically or socioculturally. So that there's one chapter critiquing the term of use of magic that focuses on Sri Vidya tradition, but it's not the only goddess chapter in here, is it? There are a couple more. Do you want to say a word about them?
Yes. Well, this is actually the chapter that is really, that really revolves around the goddess, but goddesses are indeed found in other chapters. For instance, by Chiara Policardi, so the chapter on the female Ganesha. So she traces the background of the elephant-faced goddess in medieval Shaiva tantric traditions. So Chiara has been studying yoginis, so these demi goddesses or supernatural beings, female supernatural beings, which are indeed, well, controversial. Let's say it's kind of difficult to, first of all, understand about their origin. And in the past, some scholars have, I think quite uncritically, just hypothesized that yoginis derive from a non-Aryan substratum. They are non-Brahmanical deities, entities. In fact, the temples dedicated to them are found in the so-called tribal belt, the Munda belts of India. So central India, eastern India, Odisha, Madhya Pradesh, etc. And this may be true, after all. So we might have really... it might be a kind of cult that was Brahmanized at some point, but was not Brahmanical at the beginning. And in fact, she focused on this goddess that was probably a folk goddess, so a kind of local, original, non-Brahmanical goddess, but which was incorporated into Brahmanism. And she made comparison also with another goddess, Jeshta, which is a goddess that was already found in kind of Tardo-Vedic texts, and which has an iconography as well, but not has not been studied, and so these yoginis are actually really encompassing a lot of these local cults, and so this chapter is also interesting because it marries, so to speak, the study of texts, Sanskrit texts, with the study of iconography, so the statues and bas-relief of this deity found in these open-air temples, yogini temples in central India.
Can we say that there is an affinity between, or would you say that there's a great overlap between goddess traditions and tantric traditions?
I would say yes. It's a stereotype. Probably it has been abused in the past, but it's true. You tend to have goddesses in tantra. For example, you can contrast the transgressive, you know, like non-dual traditions, Shakta tradition in tantrism, which in fact do have goddesses, or even the Bhairava, so the masculinized tradition, they have goddesses with the Siddhanta. The Siddhanta is the kind of mainstream, soft core, so to speak, tantra, which has comparatively less goddesses, or give less importance, less prominence to goddesses. So I think it is true that a lot of tantric traditions have goddesses, probably more so than Brahmanical tradition, which tend to be more masculinized.
And what was this process like for you, co-editing this volume, in terms of were there particular studies which stood out to you? Were there particular insights about tradition? I'm sure it's a rich and variegated process, but what sort of stood out to you in terms of editing this volume?
Yes. There are a couple of chapters that indeed I think are quite important and really espouse the intellectual agenda of the volume. The very first chapter is by Ronald Davidson, More Pre-Tantric Sources of Tantrism, Skulls and Skullcaps. Now, this is a kind of provocative, if you wish, chapter. It's one of a series of studies written by this scholar. And I find it interesting because it looks at pre-tantric source of tantra. I think one of the problems of the study of tantra nowadays is that most scholars kind of stop at the first a level of evidence, that is the earliest properly tantric text, which go back to the early sixth century, we can say. And but obviously, you know, it was not a tabula rasa, right? So this phenomenon developed on a kind of ground that already existed, and this ground already included what we might call popular religions, folk religions, whatever, and of course also Brahmanical religions, very much Vedic, a kind of post-Vedic religion. And so what Ronald Davidson tries to do is to look for, pre-tantric, agents in this case, or cults, practices, like the practices that use skulls as skull cups. And these are very much, so the scholars tend to define these practices as belonging to the class of the category of practitioners called kapalikas, so these very extreme transgressive ascetics who use skulls to drink liquor, to eat. And they actually had also like female partners. They danced, they sang. So they are very, very much non-Brahmanical. But the problem is that this is our first level of evidence, and also very scant, because we don't have original scriptures by the kapalikas. So scholars tend to say, well, this is a kapalika feature, but they ignore the fact that before the kapalikas, before the first, the earliest evidence about this group, there already existed practitioners and ideas, having to do with the ritual use of skulls and skull cups. And so this is a kind of risky business, right, to look at pretextual evidence. But I think Ronald Davidson looks at, for example, the Pali Canon or text in Chinese, which are considerably earlier than the secondhand sources that mention the Kapalika. And so we can actually scavenge evidence here and there to reconstruct the genesis, the prehistory, if you will, of this movement, especially the Kapalika movement. And also the chapter that I co-wrote with Alexandra Venta actually very much has to deal with that. And so we focus on the Shmashanika, so on this, non-tantric or pre-tantric, category of practitioners, or simple cremation ground workers, which are defined in the Pali Canon, but especially in this kind of shared Buddhist and Shaiva culture of magic. We call it magical substratum, that that really, well, from the study of the substratum, and you don't really even have to hypothesize the substratum. You just study the early Shaiva and Buddhist tantric texts, you find a lot of similarities. For example, the magical formulas, the ingredients that used, and you really find a kind of, cremation ground lore, and especially the instructions to find and to use skulls and other impure objects. For example, the clothes of a dead person, of a chandala, so of an outcast, right? And so this kind of lore, we can call it, you don't only find in this tantric text, but in much earlier texts. And so we wanted to show that there is a kind of continuity there. And so that's why we use the word substratum. Please go ahead.
Please continue.
I can add one more chapter number 3 by Michael Slober, entitled Shamans and Buddha Tantricas, Is There Genealogy? ? So we all know shamanism is a contested term, but I agree with Michael. According to Michael, we can use the term shaman or shamanism if we define it. So we have a kind of broad definition of this term that is anything that has to do with, say, intermediaries between the supernatural, invisible world and visible world. So operators of, for example, that have to do with healing, right? And all these things that you don't only find, you find in like the Brahmanical civilization, the Brahmanical culture, but also non-Brahmanical milieu. So the spirit, the cult of spirit being, exorcism, possession. You find them in India everywhere, okay? In both Brahmanical and non-Brahmanical milieu. For example, among the so-called tribal or the kind of non, Indo-Aryan speaking people. And he tried to show that kind of revive the old theory that the world shaman, so samana, comes from the shramana, so the word shramana in Sanskrit, and it has been kind of borrowed by people in Central Asia and East Asia. And so the Siberian shaman actually, were somehow, there were kind of, there's a kind of phylogenetic relationship there. And it brings out some convincing linguistic evidence, actually, without saying that, the shramanas or the aesthetics that the Buddha mentioned are the same as actual shamans. But there is an interesting, I think, argument there to be made. And Michael is studying the Buddha Tantras and the Garuda Tantras. So this very, let's say, neglected and very ancient corpus of tantric texts devoted to, for example, healing from snake bites or driving away malignant spirits. And these texts have really scantily been preserved because they fell out of fashion. They are very practical, we can say magic oriented. And already in India, the kind of prevalent tantric fashion of the 6th-7th century, they kind of, they didn't like this stuff. It was kind of too practical. They wanted more, probably, the new philosophical tantra or other manifestation of high tantra. And so this what is interesting about this text is that still you can find some tropes, some practices that seem to have been carried out by the non-Indo-Aryan speaking communities or the Austroasiatic speaking communities of India. For example, certain association between metal and spirit that you also find in the Brahmanical text. For example, metal is associated with demons, in Indian lore. And Austroasiatic people happen to be very good in metallurgy. Also, he has found evidence of borrowings of, let's say, Munda people deities, especially female deities, in these tantras. And so not the other way around. So we have not a case of Sanskritization, but actually of adoption, borrowing from let's say, mainstream Sanskritic Brahmanical culture of tribal elements. And so this is, I think, important to show that Tantra is more complex than previously assumed, and that there are both, you know, two-way transfers between different milieu, not only the high, you know, elite written, let's say, literary Tantra, but also the folk and practices that maybe prima facie we would not, you know, link to Tantra.
Mm. Fascinating. I have to say that Michael Sluber's argument is fascinating, and I actually did not realize the potential etymological link between shamans and shamana traditions. But having said that, the majority of my teaching these days is in a continuing studies environment, adult learners. Some have a great deal of knowledge about all things Indic, and some don't. And so I often try to create analogs or corollaries to express ideas and, you know, in teaching sort of the history of Indic traditions. Obviously, we start with the Vedic tradition, and then we move on to this, what I think of as this renouncer, you know, sort of revolution or reformation that becomes, that penetrates tradition over a number of centuries. And just describing them to a more general audience, I often say, reclusive shamanic figures, you know, without using it as a technical term. So I was actually really fascinated to know that there is perhaps some evidence of relating the term shamana to shamans. And also regarding the first two papers you described, particularly Ronald Davidson's, yeah, you know, I don't find it perilous at all to make conjecture that about phenomena that occurs before textual tradition. Actually, quite the opposite. I think that we have so internalized in the Western academic tradition and in Western culture at large, we've internalized the religious vision of tradition starting with and being grounded in text. And we really have to continually unlearn that and remind ourselves that it may very well be the case in South Asian traditions that texts are condensations of vibrant traditions, and that teachings are very much alive, not in text to this day. I've studied with a number of teachers, of emic teachers, and teachings directly pertinent to texts are not actually in texts. And there may have been times when the texts themselves had yet to be brought into being, at least in their Sanskritic forms that we have them now often. And so I think it is important to think of texts not necessarily as the beginning of a tradition, but potentially as the articulation or condensation or crystallization of pre-existing religious phenomena. Let's maybe tie in a couple of the other papers. So in addition to these traditions of what we think of as South Asia, it appears that we have vibrant tantric traditions in what we think of as Southeast Asia as well, isn't it?
Yes, indeed. So we have 9 chapters in the book and try to cover pretty much, you know, most of, let's say, the regions where you have vibrant tantric traditions in India and Southeast Asia. So we have a chapter on, comparative chapter actually, on Tantra, magical Tantra in Bengal, Bali, and Java. And also a chapter on Tantrism and the were-tiger lore of Burma, Thailand, and Cambodia. So we have both mainland and island Southeast Asia. And this is, it is often, you know, this area, this region, has been often overlooked, not only by scholars of Tantra, I say, but also by South Asianists. Whereas in the past, it was very much, you know, part of this, of a kind of cosmopolis, as Sheldon Pollock has defined a Sanskrit cosmopolis, but there were other cosmopolis, or not cosmopolis, but let's say pandemonians, you know, so like kind of demonological cosmopolis, as David White has called it. So this, so the first chapter by June McDaniel. So June McDaniel is a scholar who has started her career with the study of Bengal Tantra, so Tantra in northeastern India. And then she has also taken an interest in Bali and Java. And this is a chapter I quite like because indeed it tries to find the common ground between, let's say, high and low Tantra, you know, the folk and the elite Tantra, and so what we call magic, in both areas, so in Eastern India and also Bali and Java. And even as far as Java is concerned, in Islamic context, so in contemporary Java, where you have, in fact, the kind of, you know, Islam became the dominant religion already starting in the 16th, 17th century, but you still have a lot of what we call Hindu-Buddhist elements that are carried forward, that still survive in the culture, very much part of the culture and the everyday life of people. And so you have a very many, let's say, practitioners who seem to be, they are kind of nominally Islamic, but they're basically, you know, they have Indic mantras and they still have manuscripts that contain different degrees of, you know, let's say Indic or Indicized material. And so it makes sense to study them comparatively. So she also studied, for example, the similar category of healer and black magicians from Bali. And I think these practitioners really use texts that we can say stem from some tantric tradition, all right? Even though there is a lot, of course, of regional, you know, local Southeast Asian peculiar to the place, but we cannot just study them, I think, in isolation. And so it is very important to kind of study both South and Southeast Asia in parallel, because studying these materials from Southeast Asia can actually give us new insights also about, let's say, the material in the so-called homeland, you know, in India itself. And also interesting is the last chapter by Francesco Briganti about indeed the were-tiger lore in mainland Southeast Asia. And so this is something that I really wanted to have a chapter that indeed brings together elements, you know, that are not usually, you don't find, right, together. So what has were tiger lore to do with Tantra? Right? It seems that it has at the level of practitioners, for example, because this lore is actually mixed with various layers of folk practices and practitioners, but also high Buddhism, for example, Mahayana Buddhism and now Theravada Buddhism. So there are what we think, what we call Buddhism, is actually, you know, really it kind of a different configurations in different places. And in Southeast Asia, there's a lot of what we call magic, you know, talismans, mantras, diagrams, and filters, and so on. And well, it seems that there's a lot of hybrid, you know, hybridization going on. And so there were tantric traditions in these places, in Cambodia, for example, in Thailand, you know, up to the 13th, 14th century, and even after, perhaps, kind of survivals, you know, that have survived almost to the present, you can say. So it still makes sense to look at the written sources or at the living tradition to see how this probably local motif of the were tiger, you know, this kind of shamanic, you can say, element, has been mixed and hybridized with Buddhist, perhaps even Shaiva, tantric traditions in the past and in the present. So yes, we really wanted to kind of have in the book some chapters dealing with Southeast Asia, because we wanted to bring out the importance of this region that is often overlooked, precisely because we don't have as many written sources as in other regions. But of course, we still have manifestations of Tantra that have a kind of, you know, genealogical connection with Tantra that are not necessarily written and not necessarily, you know, Shaiva or Buddhist. For example, in Java, we have some Islamic, you know, I could even say some kind of Islamic Tantra, if you wish. And so this is, I think, important to stress.
Absolutely fascinating, I have to say. Listen, could you say a quick word about the the field of Tantra studies, and in particular, just underscore, perhaps will be slightly repetitive, but just underscore what it is this volume does within the field of Tantra studies.
Yes, well, as I said at the beginning, first of all, this volume really highlights the geographically wide approach to Tantra. And this is not something obvious, you know, we cannot take it for granted, because as of now, there is a lot of, you know, everybody prays, let's say, the kind of, you know, inter-civilizational, you know, intra-Asian connections. But still, our departments, you know, academic departments are organized according to very strict geographical, you know, lines drawn in the post-war, in the Cold War period, basically, South Asia, Southeast Asia, Central Asia, East Asia. And we specialize usually in one, you know, tradition, in one language or two. And so this volume really wanted to give this geographically wide approach. We don't want to talk about, you know, states or, but about monsoon Asians, about this context, this enormous region, very diverse, but with some, you know, let's say factors that are shared, that partially shared history, you can say. Then again, there is the problem of chronology. So this volume, the first three chapters specifically deal with this controversial, if you wish, aspect of tantric studies. So this kind of it's not a quest for the origins, but it's just looking at continuities at the development, at the genesis of this phenomenon in the long durée. So going before the kind of, you know, the first textual evidence properly tantric. So looking at other sources of evidence, textual, of course, but also non-textual. And also we have a problem of milieu. I think Tantra has focused a lot, still focusing a lot on Sanskrit texts. And it is natural because Sanskrit texts are the most numerous, probably the most ancient. And so most of people studying Tantra are Sanskritists. Okay, but there is also a very important vernacular dimension. For example, in Indian vernacular languages or in Southeast Asian vernacular languages like Old Javanese, for example, or Balinese. And so I think this volume tries at least makes a gesture, so to speak, in that direction, toward a direction of putting on the same, you know, intellectual level, Sanskrit and non-Sanskrit sources, and also different milieu. So we have the Sanskrit, the elite on the one hand, the high Tantra, which has really attracted a lot of attention, but also the low Tantra, let's say the folk, not to say that it is low, you see, but just to say that it is, for example, not written, you know, or it is indeed belonging to the so-called tribal, so non-Brahmanical context. And so this really have, these two levels are not compartmentalized, so neatly. There's a lot of interaction going on, both geographically and, you know, between different milieu. So this, we wanted to bring out this phenomena that are still difficult to define, right? Magic, shamanism, and Tantra itself is also not easy to define, but I think it kind of makes sense. There is something there, there are overlaps, you know, there are phenomena that you cannot just, you know, discount as figments of scholars' imagination, but there are really living practices there, there are beliefs that you can make sense of by drawing from all these different categories. And so this is, I think, rather innovative approach. In the field of tantric studies, of course, it is, you know, probably it will draw some criticism, but we really wanted to, let's say, stimulate perhaps a debate, start a debate, and open new vistas on this phenomenon that remains difficult to understand.
And criticism is fine. This is in large measure the dharma, you know, of a scholar, of someone, yeah, critically engaging work, and certainly that's not the MO of podcast. My dharma is to put forth the merits and the contours of any particular work. But you know, certainly my work is not above critique, and no one's is. The critical engagement is great. It needs to happen. Having said that, for those of us who have critical engagement skills and are able to think in certain ways, which probably would include, you know, all of the guests on this podcast and many of the listeners, that's not nearly as difficult as pushing the envelope, as advancing, as positing something. And so, yes, critiquing can be done. Absolutely. The use of the word magic, the boundaries, the quote unquote, you know, air quotes, anachronism, what have you. Having said that, the merits of a work that are leading with praxis, right? People do things before they name what they're doing. And sometimes they never name what they're doing. And you go to another culture and that culture has named what you've been doing. And you learn a different language. Oh, they name that. They call that into their conscious mind. Oh, they make a distinction with that. We don't do that in our language. Oh, and so clearly it's wise to take one's lead from what people are doing and how they understand tradition, irrespective of whether or not they specifically use the word tantra that obviously came into being at a certain point in history, as we're all well aware. But it's not the case that, you know, a group of people decided to write some texts and spread the good news and said, hey, we're going to be tantricas now. That could not be the case.
Yeah.
There has to be a history. There has to be a context. And there has to be a reason why these practices are so assimilatable, if that's a word, into so many other traditions, right? And so
yeah.
I find this work utterly fascinating. So let me end with this question. What is the next step for you in particular? Is this, what's next? What are you researching on next?
Yes. Well, I would like to continue, you know, and to follow this trajectory. I would like to continue also to study, for example, tantric texts from Java and Bali. So in vernacular language and Sanskrit, to show that, again, this text can be very useful. We can study that as cultural product in their own terms, of course, but also in a comparative way. And for example, use them to recover a strand of Tantra that was lost in India, you know, that probably goes back to the 5th, 6th, 7th century. And then everything changed and, you know, so this material is important. So the periphery, let's study the periphery, the so-called peripheries of the Indic world, to understand Tantra as a general category, but also the historical development of the phenomenon. So I would like, for example, I would like to continue also to kind of bring into the picture also the Chinese material, which is very interesting. There is Chinese canonical Buddhist material as a lot of very early, you know, pre-tantric, proto-tantric, tantric material. For example, the Garuda Tantras, you know, some fragments have survived. Even Shaiva material has been incorporated, you know, in Buddhist scriptures. There's a lot about possession, for example, avesha, so now this particularly associated with Shaivism or Bhairava Tantra. So it's for me very interesting, again, to study Tantra, you know, in the periphery, and to understand better in a more holistic way the phenomenon. I really would like to continue to do that and expand my current also, you know, regions. I cannot, of course, study Chinese material, but other scholars can join and we can, you know, bring our expertise and try to make sense of this very multicultural phenomenon.
Brilliant. We'll certainly have you back on the podcast at some point, whether to discuss a book, a conference, a development in the field of Tantra studies. Thank you for appearing today.
Thank you, Raj.
For those listening, we have been speaking, of course, with Dr. Andrea Acri, who is the co-editor of a fascinating new contribution to the Routledge Studies in Tantric Traditions series. It's called Tantra Magic and Vernacular Religions in Monsoon Asia. Keep well, keep listening, keep reading, keep thinking, keep reflecting, and keep contemplating the interplay, if any, between Tantra and magic. Take care.